This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or tieke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family. A family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on its back, which according to legend is the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the tieke from total extinction.
Community or chaos? We can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have Grace Salforn with us. He has had a career in medical physics and explored international trends in health reform, and combined with his fascination with how organizations worked. So when he retired in 2002, he developed these interests by forming a United Nations Association club in Tauranga, and he has developed a special interest in climate change and economic development in less developed places. Gray, could you, well, first, you can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. And now we can talk to Gray Salforn. Gray, could you tell us why you became interested in foreign affairs and world order and how that matches up with your Quakerism?
Well, I've always been interested in international affairs from a very early stage, but didn't have much ability to do anything about it. And when I was working in hospitals, I took an interest in health reforms in various countries and started to get an idea of how I could make a difference there. But when I retired through the UNA and understanding what the UN can do, it sort of opened up the incredible possibilities, and I took an interest in climate change then and peace and security, which I believe is one of the really difficult issues we've got to face.
Could you talk to us about the present apparent diminishment of world order?
Well, there are so many things happening. The whole structure, power structure is changing. People talk about the decline of the West and the rise of the rest, with the particularly decline of the United States and a whole lot of other countries starting to become more important, like China and India and Brazil and a number of others. It's disrupting relationships all around. Economies have failed and developed great inequalities, and many billionaires have been generated, and many people left out of this prosperity. There's an economic crisis, climate change, the species lost, and a threat to our future from our lifestyles. It produces an incredible moral dilemma we've got, which we're having real difficulty coming to terms with. The internet has provided a massive networking, global networking, in which everybody can link from to anywhere else virtually. And it's changing, opening up a lot of relationships and possibilities of information, social media and all that sort of thing. There's lots of other technologies with wonderful benefits they have, but they virtually all bring challenges and even threats. Things like artificial intelligence, biological technologies, especially genetic modification, technology in space and energy, lots of other things. And that's developed wealth creations. There are actually 3,000 billionaires in the world. And what do they do with their money? And leadership seems to
be
rather weak.
How much of the percentage of the wealth do these billionaires own? And they're bigger than many countries, aren't they?
They tend to focus on the on the United States, but people with that sort of wealth are spreading money around the world, and you never know where their commitments lie.
Do they have influence by that?
Oh yes, yeah. The ability to support things, they can support very valuable things. On the other hand, they can corrupt governments, and many politicians can be bought.
Is Musk and Trump, are they examples of this, of one extreme of the billionaires?
Yeah. That's a great example of billionaires virtually taking over the government. And making massive changes in the government, in this case, very destructive changes.
Could you talk about the fact that the Google and the internet, it's gives us lots of information, but does it also tend to make us shallow? Because you can get so much shallow information, but you often stop there. And also you get the information that Google already thinks you want, or that Google wants to promote in the way of promotion or advertising. Also, doesn't Google use a heck of a lot of carbon? And doesn't it have a large effect as far as climate warming?
Well, you've touched on a number of different things there. It's not only Google, but there's Facebook, there's TikTok, there's a number of different mediums which give us great services and make the internet come alive and our computers and other technologies provide all sorts of wonderful services, but then on the other hand, it's a system that's centrally controlled, and that control can be used for good or for ill. It's really much a corporate decision making that influences us. Sometimes very intimately in terms of our relationships. So there's a lot of interesting dilemmas in those systems.
There's the problem that our understanding of ethics and morality hasn't kept up with technology, and we often don't understand enough about technology to regulate it. Should technology be regulated in the common interest?
Well, that presents a problem. Certainly there have been attempts to do that, but it comes across a range of very interesting issues. First of all, these are internationally managed systems. And so the only real way to influence these organizations is for many countries to come together and work together on that. And that's a real challenge with this complex society, the need for cooperation and how nations can cooperate together. Of course, the UN is a major factor in there, but it's not the only one.
You just attended, I believe, at the University of Otago, a 3-day conference on foreign affairs, concentrating on how medium-sized and small states can affect their future and the world's future, how much influence they can have, and their difficulty with navigating all the changes. And also navigating Trump, I suppose.
Yes, yes. Small countries like New Zealand and lots of other small countries have real challenges in this direction. But there are ways in which small countries can influence it. And this conference addressed a number of factors involved in that. It does represent challenges that we're not very good at handling at this stage.
Could you comment on the decline of Western empire, especially the United States? And could you talk about this and what it might mean for the future?
Well, this is a very big issue. Going back a little bit, when you look at the 1990s, this is the end of the Cold War, if you remember, and the Russian Empire, USSR, had basically collapsed. And that all the different countries were becoming independent. And the Western countries, and particularly the US, were riding supreme. They had demonstrated that they had the best civilization, and they controlled the world. And the United States, with its enormous armies and bases around the world, was ruled supreme, in fact. But perhaps there is a level of complacency.
How about hubris?
They didn't notice that a lot of things are happening around the world, and it turns out that they are becoming, well, second rate. The action has moved substantially to other countries, countries that we wouldn't expect in Africa and South America and in Asia, that that are starting to take over from to dominate the future technologies and the power structures. So that is impacting on the world in many, many ways.
As the real changes have been in the economy, I mean, East Asia, particularly China, is probably the biggest economy now in the world. And the U.S. economy has shrunk to some degree. But they're still the biggest military power in the world. Have they been tempted to use their military power to push things in the way they prefer? Was going into Iraq, for instance, was that a mistake, or did that help?
Oh, well, it's been well recognized that the invasion of Iraq was a big mistake. It was done on false premises and against all the rules of the United Nations. That's had enormous implications, particularly when we're looking at Ukraine. And how can we criticize Russia in its invasion of Ukraine when the United States has done some of the things? Well,
maybe they both need to be criticized, and maybe when a country's being invaded, the world needs to do everything it can to stop that.
Yeah.
Could you talk about the rise of the former less developed countries, the BRICS, and China, and particularly China, and the U.S. reaction to China, and also how the changes in the United States now may influence the world?
Well, that is another big issue. The world order that came out of the out of the United Nations and which was affirmed at the end of the Cold War was very largely designed by Western nations, and not always to the benefit of other nations. Some of these growing nations that I referred to before felt that they were being left out and that they needed to find ways of supporting their interests. And so there's a group of countries, initially five of them, that started to grow, form what they call the BRICS of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, started to come together and look at how they could develop better economics social system, economic and development support systems that were more in line. And they have been joined with another five others now, including Indonesia and UAE and Iran, that are working together to develop better systems. And to an extent, that's in opposition to the established systems and creating a concern among some people. In fact, Trump threatened great tariffs, enormous tariffs for any countries which tried to develop an alternative financial system.
Actually, these countries aren't against world order per se. I know, for instance, China depends on the world economic order and recognizes that publicly.
Oh, yes. China, in view of the erratic role that the U.S. has been taking recently, China has been able to present itself as the stable rock supporting the world order, including the UN, and a center of reliable support. It's sort of turning the tables in a rather dramatic way on the systems that we're used to.
Okay, we'll have some music now and then we'll come back. That was Darren Watson and Too Many Millionaires. And perhaps he should have said Too Many Billionaires, but Too Many Millionaires. We have with us Gray Southern talking about world affairs. And you can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. Oh, Gray, could you talk about the failure or success of neoliberalism and what's been the results politically and socially?
Yes, well, neoliberalism was a regeneration of older economic system from century below before, but it came in the 70s and 80s when the Keynesian economic system was that we had from the Second World War was having problems with what they call stagflation. And these economists came in with an alternative system to regenerate the economy based on giving the business a free hand, getting government out of business and letting business rip and bring wealth that's going to provide for everybody. And
theory of trickle down, that if enough billionaires had enough money, the money would all come pouring down to the average person. Did it work that way?
Well, some people benefited, but overall, there were a lot of people that didn't, as I mentioned before. But it did. It also concentrated the wealth and allowed for a lot of exploitation, including environmental exploitation. So overall, it really wasn't very successful, but it persisted and it's still in play in many ways.
Aren't many politicians who accepted it are afraid to admit that it isn't working because they accepted it for so long?
Yeah, I puzzled about that. And it seemed that everybody hated it, but nobody could do anything about it. And I came to the conclusion that it was a simple answer. It was a simple system which could be easily solved, and it was much easier to understand than the standard economic systems, which were incredibly complex. And so the politicians and other decision makers were left with that's the only thing that could understand and sell them. So that's the businesses liked it, and they paid lots of money. So so it's persisted for quite a long time.
It still persists, doesn't it? Really?
Well, yeah, as I said, it's still in many respects.
But it's succeeded in some regards because it's actually change the distribution of money. It's moved the distribution of money from the poor to the rich.
It concentrates the wealth enormously, and that's creating a lot of
that creates disorder, doesn't it?
It's destabilizing society. and makes government more dependent on what the wealthy for the support.
Could you discuss the recent, with the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, the recent emphasis on security and the effect that fear has on relationships and the stability of the world?
Yes, there's this overall uncertainty and particularly the Russian invasion creates a lot of concern and people looking for security. And a number of the problems we've got in society is people look so much to the military of for security. And in addition, certain leaders have advantage in cultivating enemies to bring this community together and bring them credibility. And there are many organizations which benefit preparation and conduct of war. So these factors combine to make military an increasingly important part of our society and our attempt to make sense of this confusion we've got. What is ignored is that there are much more constructive ways of addressing your problems. There's diplomacy, particularly, and preemptive engagement to solve problems before they arise, and cooperation. And the more countries cooperate, the more they realize the importance, the values of getting together to solve all sorts of problems and to develop their economies, develop their lifestyles. And if countries cooperate, and they do to a considerable extent, then they realize that the stability of their cooperation is so crucial that they don't want that disrupted. And many companies don't want their stability disrupted too. So the more we can focus on that, the more people will be disinclined to look for the military to solve their problems.
Could you talk about the fact that many of the problems the world faces, such as climate change and feeding the world and the spread of nuclear weapons, aren't these all factors that actually need cooperation and need world order?
Well, indeed. Just about every major problem requires countries to work together in some form or other. And may take a lot of different forms, and the UN is always working in a lot of different areas. And so if we don't cooperate, then we're in a very bad way. And I think it's fair to say that our future depends principally on that ability to work together. And so it's not easy, it takes a lot of effort, but it's by far the only way to address a lot of the problems we've got. Think of the oligarchs, the billionaires that have got this enormous capabilities that over many countries, and they can trade one country off the other and get pursue their interests by exploiting the differences between countries.
Well, I'm going to play another song, and then we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
That was Eric Vogel and Dreamer, and we're talking with Grace Southern about international relations. Could you talk about the NATO conference, the recent NATO conference?
Yes, yes. That is a major issue. It just occurred less than a week ago. A nation in The Hague, the Center for Global Justice and Peace. And this was a major summit meeting of NATO. And in the context of the war on Ukraine and the need to defend the to solve the war in some way or other, and the president of Ukraine was there, Zelensky. And although he's not a NATO member, he played an important part. And basically, it was about bringing the NATO members, which constitute nearly all the EU, together to increase their military expenditure up to 5% from between 1 and 2%. They're increasing it up to 5%, which is a major sacrifice for some. They have to reduce their aid or reduce their social services to put these funds into the military, to focus their industry on military effort and their education, getting schools to get people familiar with using arms, all in order to support the Ukraine against the
against an invasion, really.
Against the invasion from Russia, and it was there was very little consideration of negotiation, or negotiation was was considered, though in a very aggressive form, not really considering the Russian perspectives. So Russia was essentially demonized, and that was the center of their efforts.
Wasn't it to be expected, though, that if a country invaded another country, that there would be this reaction, that people would be frightened and also dislike them? I mean, that's to be expected, isn't it?
Well, it certainly, and I've got a lot of sympathy for the people of the Ukraine who have made enormous sacrifices and suffered a lot of damage and death and displacement during this war. And it needs to be addressed in any way possible. But it's not clear that their approaches are the most effective.
Are there other things that are damaging the world order, and well, particularly around the rules of war, like what's happened in Gaza, the ethnic cleansing in Gaza, and the in bombing, sudden, fairly aggressive bombing of Iran. While Iran was not at war at the present, or actually taking part in war.
Yes, well,
I mean, they like the United Nations, they like the United States did encourage other groups to take part in their attacks. It seems to be that what nations do is they may not attack another nation, but they may get other people to attack another nation. And I think that happens on both sides of the... wasn't it a breaking of the rules of law to bomb Iran?
Yes. Well, I think most people, it seemed fairly clear that was the case, that the Israeli attack on Iran was illegal, but Israel argued that they felt that Iran was in the process of developing a war, a bomb that could they would use against Israel, so Israel had to act. This is at the same time as Israel has and had nuclear weapons for quite a long time, and so it's it seemed to be fairly lopsided thinking there.
Does all this put the rule of law at stake? Do they put the rule of law at stake? Both Putin and you, and Israel, and now the United States. Do their actions risk more war and put the laws and regulations we have that we hope will prevent war? Don't they? They damage those. They damage the rule of law, don't they?
Well, certainly.
All these contenders.
Yeah. The more people can disobey the rule, law, and they're not prevented in any way, then it undermines the credibility of the rule of law and of the United Nations. This follows from the failure of Israel to obey a whole range of different declarations,
including
by the United Nations.
The two-state solution.
Yes, it makes
with their,
it...
settlement of the West Bank, they make the two-state solution less possible?
That's right, yes. It's increasingly difficult to imagine a way in which a long-term peace can be developed. But the methods of cooperation... do have a chance of developing the appreciation of the value of working together, even in those environments. We've got to remember that following the Second World War, the states of Europe had been been in conflict for quite a few centuries before that. And there was a lot of legacy of bitterness, and yet they managed to get around that in a very extensively with only in a few years, with a little bit of assistance from the countries, other countries like the United States, and they built the EU over time. They built the cooperation, they built the trust and the confidence within this range number of states, over 20 states, that slowly came together to build the EU. So resolutions are possible if the effort is put into it. Mind you, after World War II, they were so exhausted and so devastated that they've determined to find a better way of operating, and they found it. And so that demonstrates the capability of human effort if the people really want to find an answer.
Isn't this one of the reasons the UN is very important?
Oh, yes, indeed, indeed.
And should we make an effort to support the UN, not only politically, but economically? The United States has just cut their support of the UN, especially UN development agencies and other agencies connected to the UN that were trying to safeguard human beings and raise their standard of living. Through health and education and other ways. So do the countries like New Zealand, like European Union and Canada, should they actually volunteer to give more money to the UN to supplement what Trump's taking away?
Yes, yes, that is certainly true. Something which is so precious to you is failing, you need to put in much more effort to establish it. Something we need to pay more attention to.
Now, it seems to me is the time to really support the UN.
Yes.
It's a sign of neglected or poor world citizenship if you withdraw support from the UN, as the United States seems to be doing. And so the rest of the world should not follow that example, should they?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think New Zealand's got a great opportunity to make an effort here. They've got a reputation of doing the right thing, epitomized by the anti-nuclear stand, and to front up for when the world is in crisis and promote real answers. And I want to say a word about our anti-nuclear stance. It's not a trivial issue by any means. The reality that we were faced with is that the great powers were presenting us with the situation that we are asked to seek our security from the ability to destroy civilization. And what New Zealand did is stand up against that and say, look, that's doesn't make sense. That is destroying our security. We're not, by threatening that catastrophe, we declare that our future is away from nuclear weapons. And that has gone on to just a few years ago, along with a lot of other nations. In fact, two-thirds of the General Assembly, we formed the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
Doesn't that make it important that we don't necessarily support more militarization in the Pacific, as in AUKUS, the treaty between Australia, Great Britain, and the United States and others that they'd like to join? Should we try to support as much as we can the a nuclear-free Pacific.
Well, certainly a nuclear-free and an arms-free. Nuclear weapons are really very important, but they're not the only concern. They can do a lot of damage, destruction with non-nuclear weapons. So we need to be looking at the arms in general. And many Pacific nations are looking for a military-free territory.
Okay, thanks a lot for coming on board, and hope that some of our dreams come true and not the nightmares.
I think we've got a lot of possibilities.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.